This is React Podcast. I'm Chantastic. Today, Adam Wathen tells us what it takes to make your own money. He's a prolific author, podcaster, educator, open source creator, and true full stack developer. He shares a look into what it took to make refactoring UI and Tailwind CSS smash hits. But first, let's talk about Infinite Red. If you're building a React or React Native app and you're feeling stuck, check out Infinite Red. They're pro unstuckers for React and React Native projects. They've helped hundreds of companies like yours build beautiful, functional web and mobile apps. And they teach you as you build together. They've taught tens of thousands of developers through open source and their annual React Native conference, Chain React. React Podcast listeners get two tickets to Chain React Comp in 2021 for referring or starting a new project. Visit reactpodcast.infinite.red and build a beautiful, functional app today. Adam Wathen, welcome to React Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm super excited to have you on the show because I feel like even though you're not like in the direct circle of React, you know, I know you do a lot more work in PHP and Vue and CSS. So much of your work intersects. There's like a Venn diagram and like you're squarely in the middle with some of your projects.
So sure.
It's good to have you on the show. First and foremost, I just want to know, like, what are you up to? What are you working on like right now?
Yeah. So right now I am working on this project Tailwind UI, which is like our attempt at launching sort of a commercial branch of Tailwind CSS to be able to keep working on that project and turn it into something like sustainable that we can kind of work on full time. So we just did like an early access launch of that about 2.5 or 3 weeks ago. And things are finally calming down a little bit and continuing to just like hack away on that and build out new UI components and stuff for our customers.
That's awesome. Now, I want to talk a lot about kind of like the inspiration and all that. But in terms of the launch, you guys just launched tailored, like kind of like designed, fully designed components in Tailwind. That's kind of the pro offering that you have right now.
Yeah, exactly. We kind of think of it as like an analogous to like Bootstrap's theme store, for example, but kind of our own spin on it, where instead of selling like themes, we kind of wanted to try doing something that was more just like this big directory that was just kind of categorized based on sort of your needs. So instead of just buying like a template for a specific site, you're just kind of paying for access to like a big directory of, oh, I need a table. Well, here's like 10 really nice looking tables we've designed. You can kind of pick one that makes sense for you based on the type of data you need to display or whatever. Or here's 5 different application shells, whether you want like a sidebar on the left or like a stacked navigation, or, you know, just basically give you like a bunch of more polished pre-designed Lego blocks that you can use as a starting point. And they're all just like HTML snippets. So it's not like a NPM library or anything you install. It's literally just, we built it, you pull it in, and then you own the code and customize it however you want, which is kind of nice because I find with most of this other stuff in this space, you get like this zip file and it has its own build process and you can't integrate it into your workflow at all. And they're using SAS and you're using styled components or something, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just a disaster. So we thought if we just have, it's just HTML, Tailwind makes that easy, of course, since Tailwind just tries to keep you in the HTML anyways. You kind of know exactly what you're getting. It's just like one format, do with it what you will. And that's been working out pretty good so far. Yeah.
I think that's one thing that's really fun about this like style of architecture, where it's like, hey, we have like a big, like kind of CSS file, I guess, and it's framework independent.
Yeah.
And once you kind of opt into this as like your like base layer or like undercurrent in a way,
yeah,
like now you can use whatever framework you want. Like just grab these snippets, throw it into React, throw it into Rails, throw it into Laravel, like you're good to go.
Totally.
Wherever you're at.
Yeah, and that's been working well so far. I mean, like we definitely have people who wish it was a little bit less work, like trying to translate raw HTML to JSX. Of course, it's not hard work, but it's like kind of tedious work. So yeah, we're trying to think of ways we can make some of that stuff easier down the road, but ultimately, like, feels like a good kind of lowest common denominator.
Yeah. I've always been bullish on standards. Like, I think that, you know, one thing that's kind of been sad to me is to see all of the like good design and CSS work that's like locked away into React these days.
Definitely. Yeah.
It seems like really sad. Like in terms of like a community thing, it just feels like almost wasteful.
It's hard, right? Because I think there's a good reason for it. There's so much power that you get from being able to do all your styles in JavaScript. But
yeah,
you're right. You're siloing it off into this, like, if you build things with React, then all this stuff is accessible to you. But if you don't, then you have to find something else. So, like, vanilla CSS is so much more popular in Vue, for example, than I think it is in React. Because, like, we can't use, like, a motion in Vue. Like, I think you can, but, like, you know, it's one of those things that, like, someone wrote in the documentation, like, yeah, it should work, I guess. Like, we didn't write it in a way to specifically make it not work, but just no one does things that way. It's like saying, yes, if you use JSX in Vue, you can do this, but again, no one does that. So
yeah, it's like everyone who, like, publishes, like, a UMD for their, like, JavaScript build, they're kind of like, it might work, I don't know. Like, I just...
depending yeah, this on is what the bundler... The bundler spat it out. Try... you know, roll the dice. But, yeah, it is... It's hard because... there's so many cool things you can do if you're willing to just, like, buy into, like, React as, like, the UI paradigm that you're going to bet on forever.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see how it shakes out long term, because there are lots of really interesting ideas there and lots of stuff that you can do such a better job at if you're willing to commit to just, like, it's JavaScript. We're going to do everything there. But at the same time, I don't think, like, vanilla CSS is going anywhere either. right. So it's a pretty safe bet. So I've always thought of, like, Tailwind as kind of like sort of a pragmatic tool that gives you a lot of the same power and benefits that you get with composition with CSS and JS, but in a way that, like, you can use this anywhere. There's limitations, of course, that aren't present in CSS and JS tools. Things like tree shaking unused styles and stuff are not as straightforward and whatever. But yeah, for a lot of people who are building a WordPress theme or something using PHP that want to be able to build it in a way that feels, like, productive, you know, we're trying to give everyone something they can use. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, I really like this. It's almost like a bet against kind of like the hype cycle, right? Because this is all standards. It's just like a bunch of classes that you can use and compose them in really cool ways inside of components, which is awesome. And I see a lot of, I think there's been, like, different approaches to this, but it really feels like Tailwind has captured a lot of attention, especially in the React space. Could you tell me, like, what's the pitch on Tailwind for anyone who's not familiar with the library already?
Sure. I think, like, the most fundamental belief behind Tailwind and likely other tools that paved the way and took similar approaches is basically that HTML is easier to maintain than CSS. That's basically the idea, right? So no matter how hard people seem to try, CSS on projects always just gets out of control. No matter how hard you try to follow all the best practices and make things as quote-unquote semantic as possible, even though that's not really the right way to think about it. Like, your class names don't really have anything to do with, like, the document structure, you know what I mean?
Right.
But no matter how hard people try to, like, make their HTML and CSS as separate as possible, things just spiral out of control, and you end up, like, what's always happened with me on projects where I was trying to do things, you know, the quote unquote recommended way, is inevitably you get dumped onto a project, you gotta change the space between an icon and a piece of text, and you're paralyzed because you just have no clue about like what the right way to do that is on this project. You know,
do I make a new class for this? Do I read like 10,000 lines of existing CSS?
And how the hell do I name that class if I am going to make a new class? So I think what people inevitably end up doing is they carve out their own special corner in the CSS file where they try to add new classes, make sure that they're not adding any styles that are going to interfere with anything else on the site, because God knows what else it's going to affect since everything in CSS is global. And you just hope for the best. And then the CSS keeps growing and growing, and dead rules just sit around forever. And then your CSS also ends up, like, mimicking your document structure, because you end up doing all sorts of, you know, yep. basically like the way people tend to approach it is they look at like their HTML, they write their classes in their HTML, and the HTML is sort of like defining the API that the CSS is going to consume. The CSS is then like, okay, these are the classes that the HTML prepared for me. So that's how I'm going to target things. Whereas like, you know, a more like quote unquote functional CSS approach, or, you know, utility first, however you want to call it, is trying to like flip the tables around. And it's kind of based on this premise that we've tried and tried our hardest to do it, you know, this quote unquote good way, and it inevitably just never works. And we always blame ourselves for just not doing it good enough. But maybe what we need to try is just like really flipping things on its head and seeing how bad, you know, the so-called anti-patterns really yeah. are. And in my experience, it turns out to just be a lot easier to build things this way. You're faster, more productive, things are more maintainable, but it's really hard to convince yourself to do it because everyone yeah. has such a like a visceral reaction because of what we've sort of been indoctrinated with over the years. So it's a hard thing to get people to try sometimes. So my experience is most people, when they actually give it a fair shake, think it's awesome and are way more productive. So,
well, this is something I've always loved about the approach, is that it does really flip the thing on its head. But like what you get in return is like there's only a fixed number of like properties that you can have. And so
yeah.
you really don't, you know, you install something like Tailwind and it's like infinitely cacheable, right? Like you kind of don't ever have to think about like more styles being added, how that affects the user. It's like it's just there, and it like sits there. They have it cached yeah. in their system, and then you can keep making UI. You can make totally. UI all day and like never affect the user.
One day maybe Tailwind will just be included in Chrome and like you won't even need to, you know what I mean? Like that's like the dream. It's just like a browser level class-based API for styling things, right? Like it's obviously that's never going to happen, but like the paradigm would support that, you know,
which yeah,
is kind of
yeah.
interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's great. It's a great, like, kind of a counterpoint. I've always liked it as, like, a counterpoint to, like, inline styles, right? Because inline styles, it's like, you can't find them ever again, right? Like, if you ever need to, like, grep for, you know, what's using, you know, like, kind of looking a certain way, like, sure. you know, someone might have put a colon with no space or, like, two spaces. Yeah. And, like, you can never, yeah. like, find those things.
Sure.
But with these, like, you have these little, like tokens, I guess, where you can be like, okay, like
yep.
where are we using all of this, and like are we using multiple classes that we could maybe pull out later into like, okay, now that we've used it 50 times, we know that this is what a card looks like.
Totally. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I like that. I think I've always been attracted to this idea of like kind of like exception first, right? Like in I think the, you know, utility class or, you know, function classes seem to mimic this idea of like you just write the code and then like figure out like what it is later, or like what you want to call it.
Yeah, let like the abstractions sort of like basically will themselves into existence out of like actual painful duplication and maintainability problems. Like the example I always give to people is like people are always like Tailwind has this feature that lets you take like a group of utilities and like extract it into a class by just like copying the list of classes and pasting it into your CSS file and sticking like a little special directive in front of it. And that feature kind of exists just to kind of make people comfortable with the idea, because they all think that it's going to be so bad to have all these utilities in their HTML. But then in reality, like so many of the things that we create classes for, like custom classes for, never actually get used twice in an app. Like think of like a nav bar at the top of your page. You don't really need a nav bar class because you only ever write the HTML for it once anyways. It
yeah.
goes in your layout.erb file or whatever, right? And it never gets written again. So the fact that it has, you know, 70 classes spread across the 12 elements that make it up doesn't actually ever matter, because
right.
You never have to change it in multiple places because there's actually no duplication. And I think what people tend to find when they actually like give it a chance is that they actually have less duplication than they think. And a lot of the things that maybe look like duplication end up not being real duplication. Like, yes, I actually do want to change this independently from this, even though like they might be the same right now. So I find just like waiting for the abstractions to sort of like demand that they exist by like actually you running into situations where it's like, I just needed to make a commit where I changed 7 of these files and made the exact same change in each one. It's like, okay, yeah, sure, now I should make an abstraction. But the way that we've written CSS historically has been the opposite. It's always been like trying to like create an abstraction for something before it even has proved it deserves an abstraction, which is not the way that we normally program, right? So it's kind of interesting for sure.
Now, this actually comes back to a talk that I've watched of yours. I think it's an older talk, but you talk about this notion of, I think maybe Kent Beck's, you did an interview with Kent Beck and you were talking about how he didn't really see a difference between kind of like the high level concepts and then like the low level, like implementation details, and how they were all kind of like related to how you think about problems. And that's really the more important thing. And that you were kind of like making this shift to really, instead of like thinking about what the next big architectural move is, or like in this case, like trying to figure out what the abstraction you're building is, like just focusing on like the work at hand, focusing on doing like
totally
the best job that you can for this feature. How has that impacted your life over the, I guess, years since that talk?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's proven to be a pretty useful way of approaching things. Like just generally the idea that, you know, in the past I would get too kind of caught up always worrying about like the big picture architecture of things and thinking like, you know, how should this, you know, application be designed? Like what abstractions should we have? What layers should there be and stuff like that? When the better thing for me to focus on, at least for the way that I like to work and like what helps me be productive, is just looking at the lines of code on the screen and thinking, how can I make these as clear and, you know, work as correctly as possible? And things tend to like emerge out of that kind of naturally. Everything, like Kent Beck kind of talked about, everything is being sort of like fractal, you know what I mean? Like it's all kind of just like the same up and down. Like a function calling another function is no different than like one layer of your application talking to another. And my experience has been like working from like the bottom up has been easier for me anyways, and more, I guess, just more pragmatic, because it's easy to get lost talking about sort of theoretical stuff when the better way to work in my experience has been to focus on the stuff that's real and tangible that you can actually look at on your screen. So yeah, that was definitely a lasting idea for me for sure.
What do you think it is about us that makes us want to like reach for the higher concepts constantly? Like, is it just dissatisfaction in having to do the work? Like, is it just, I guess, like is Stephen Pressfield says, like resistance, like is that what it is, or is it something more than that?
I don't know. For me, at least, I can say that like what's always had me interested in reading about these big ideas all the time is just always searching for that like silver bullet architecture, you know what I mean? wanting to believe that there's like a paint by numbers way to build software. So always just hoping that whatever new idea someone has, like this is going to be the one, I'm not going to have to use my brain anymore, which is ironic because I think the reason that we do what we do and enjoy what we're doing is because we get to use our brain and get to be creative. But for some reason, a lot of us are still always chasing that like one true way to do anything, right? So I think that's what kind of draws me to those ideas anyways, and I still can't resist them. You know what I mean? When I see someone talk about some new approach to building something, it's like, ooh, I have to check this out. Maybe this will solve all my problems. But inevitably it tends to not work that way. And every situation is unique and you have to unfortunately use your brain.
Yeah, it is kind of like a weird thing, because I know that the parts that I enjoy most about my work and the parts that make me like continually show up are the parts where I feel engaged. Right. And like when the work is boring, like I don't want to do it. But I'm constantly, like you said, like trying to find ways to turn my brain off. And I don't know. I haven't really found an answer to why I keep working against myself yet.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. It doesn't make a lot of sense when you really think about it. But for some reason, we're always drawn to any sort of like formula. You know what I mean? That's going to just give you like the one true way of doing things.
So I want to transition a little bit into your like career and kind of like what made you you. I think, you know, Justin Jackson put it best when he said that you're kind of like his nightmare, because you can execute on like copywriting, media design, and overall marketing strategy, and then add to that just like development.
Sure.
And so I'm curious, like, what is the experience that kind of brought you to like where you are today? Because I think full stack engineer is generally a misnomer, but I feel like you kind of like actually kind of defined the curve on that one. You have, you know, your first book was on test-driven Laravel, but then also you have like a, you know, your most recent book, which is on refactoring UI, and you've, you know, marketed a lot of this stuff yourself, you're streaming. So what brought you to all of this?
Big question. I'm not really sure I have the best answer for it. I can say like, I've always just like really loved making things and putting them out into the world, especially making things that other people find useful, right? So to me, because like my goal has always been to like create things that other people can use and benefit from, it's kind of necessitated that like I have to fill in gaps in my skill set to be able to execute on that. So I think that's where like the full stackness, I guess, kind of comes from, because I want to be able to build something, put it on the internet and have people use it and, you know, get some sort of reward from it. So I have to know how to, you know, talk to the database and build like an interactive front end and, you know, come up with some convention for how all my controllers should be set up and, you know, whatever, build an API, whatever. So yeah, I don't know. I think like I kind of stumbled into programming from a bunch of different directions throughout the course of my life. The one that kind of like really pushed me into doing it as a career finally was I was running a recording studio, recording bands for a living.
Oh, nice.
I'm using this tool called Reaper, which is like, I explain it to people as sort of like the Vim of like audio editing software. It's like super hackable. You can extend it with like your own C++ plugins and stuff like that. And there was a bunch of ideas that I had for improving my own like production workflow when I was recording bands to make like editing drum tracks faster and stuff like that. That features didn't exist in the tool, but because the tool was so hackable, I could learn how to like build these features myself. So I got into that and started like writing these scripts and adding functionality to the tool to be able to quantize drums faster and whatever. Huh. And I found myself like just like having more fun building those tools than I was having recording bands. and I was also getting a ton of satisfaction from being able to like share these plugins and stuff on like the forums for the the software. And everyone, like, you'll still see people like asking questions like they have my name in it, because like my name is just like analogous with this concept now and stuff like that, right? So I get like a lot of satisfaction out of seeing other people use my stuff and learn from it. And that's where I first started like recording screencasts and stuff. And you can even find screencasts on like my non-programming YouTube channel of me like showing people how to edit drums, where I hadn't figured out screencasting yet. So the whole thing is me like, yeah, so you'll see, we have to open up this app and, you know, like just a really unpolished screencasting where there's no energy and it's all terrible, but you know, they got thousands of views and people still comment on it saying how helpful it is. And yeah, so being able to release that stuff into the world and helping all these people was really satisfying for me. And it made me realize, man, I think like what I actually want to do is just like build stuff for a living using computers, because computers are kind of like the best tool that I have for doing that in the age that I live in. And you can actually make money doing that, which I can't recording bands. And recording bands, I'd maybe like hate recording bands, because you know, you just spoil a hobby for yourself. I kind of just went to college after that. It was like my second time going to school for computer science. I went to university for it, but I was too distracted by being in bands and just dropped out and kept doing that stuff. And then like 5 years later, or 6 years later, went back to college for software engineering and did a couple years of that until I had enough experience at school to get an internship basically, and then never went back to school and didn't finish that. So I only have a high school diploma at this point, after having gone to two post-secondary institutions, but did that and then got into sort of agency work doing like application development with Laravel. Actually, it was like my first real job.
Really?
And that was only like 2013. Yeah. And I don't know. That's a part of the story. if there's any specific stuff that you want to dig into more, just let me know.
Yeah. So I'm curious, like, it sounds like a while, like this was probably like around 2011, 2012 that you were doing those screencasts for.
Yeah, probably like maybe like 2010, 2011, 2012. Yeah. Kind of in there. That would be, yeah.
I imagine that the tools back then were not nearly as, I guess, good or readily available as they are now. And like the path not very well worn. Like, what kind of inspired you to take that route, like, way back then? It's like 8 or 9 years ago.
I don't know. I think I just, like, I've always just had a natural tendency to get really involved in communities around the things that I've been interested in, right? So even, like, so recording bands and stuff, you get into these, like, online forums where you're just, like, you're searching for how to do stuff, and you find answers on forums, and then you start participating by asking your own questions, and then eventually you have answers to questions that other people are asking. And I've just always naturally, like, tended to get involved in communities, I think, which I think is just maybe like a personality advantage that I have when it comes to the sort of career that I've created for myself now. But that's been the case for me with all kinds of different hobbies that I've had over the years. Even like I was really into competitive powerlifting for a long time, and I would participate in the forums there and put together interesting tools and whatever, invented like my own formulas for estimating like one rep maxes on lifts and stuff that I thought were more accurate than the ones that you could find online, and all sorts of crazy stuff. So I've just always kind of got involved with that sort of stuff, and that kind of led me to, you know, I always get like satisfaction of seeing someone benefit from like something I've shared, which motivates me to do more of that and more of that. So when I have like some idea for how to explain how to do something like editing drums faster, and I think, you know what, it'd be cool if I could put this into like a screencast, I just kind of figured out how to do it and threw it up on YouTube. Because you're right, it's probably a little bit early and sort of like the, I don't even know if I would say it was that early. Like you see sites like NetTuts and stuff back in the day, we're still always doing video courses and stuff, even in that kind of, even at that point in time. So early for sure, but people had paved the roads a little bit and there were tools and stuff for it. I can't even remember what I used to record and edit the videos in those days. Like probably it was just like a QuickTime screen recording, and maybe it wasn't even edited at all. Like
I love it,
because I can't think of what I would have used. Maybe I used like iMovie or something.
Sure.
But yeah.
Now you mentioned a lot about community, and communities can kind of be like a two-edged sword, right? Like you can get the positive feedback that really kind of, you mentioned, kind of drives you to produce more and to share more and to engage more. But then you also get that negative feedback a lot of times. How have you, I guess, dealt with that as you've built your career in that way of kind of working with communities?
Yeah, it's hard. Still to this day, like a negative comment will eat at me for days if it's the right type of negative comment. And it's so easy to just like brush off any positive comments and just not really like let those sink in and make you feel good when like one little negative thing can like eat at you for a long time. So I can't say I've got like a perfect strategy for that. I will say like I aggressively mute people on Twitter who are like just like toxic towards me or the work that I do. And I also just have to remind myself all the time that like, yeah, just because like for every like one negative comment I see about something, there's like 100 positive ones. So like why, I'm almost doing like a disservice to like the people who care about my work by like wasting my mental energy on the people who are detracting from it when I could be, you know, hanging out with the people who are into it, you know, doubling down on the people who care. In my head, I have to think about it like music, you know what I mean? Like there's all sorts of bands that have a raving fan base of people who just like get it. Like they get that band. They like they know what that band wants to do and like they love the music, but then there's obviously going to be people who hate it. Every band has like haters, you know what I mean? But why would you like get all bent out of shape about people who don't like what you're doing when like you're on stage playing the music you love to hundreds of people who are just like super into it, you know what I mean? Like what is there to be upset about, you know? So I have to kind of just remind myself of that constantly and try to focus more on the positive and not let the negative get to you, and just accept that like not everyone is gonna like things. It's impossible to make something that everyone's gonna like, right?
Yeah.
It's probably a bad idea to try and make something that everyone's gonna be like. Everyone's gonna like. It's better to have an opinion and kind of follow through with that and find the other people who share that opinion and enjoy your time with them. So
now you execute on like a lot of platforms. So you have you know, a thriving YouTube channel, you are on Twitter, you're writing books. Do you find that certain communities are like, how do I put this? Like, do you find that YouTube, because you can kind of like have control over the comments, or like even like Twitter to some extent have control over the conversation, kind of lend themselves better to, I guess, tailoring your audience than maybe like general forum type of stuff like Reddit, or do you work there too?
I don't really know. I haven't really thought about that too much. Like, I do stream and stuff on YouTube, but I don't think of myself as someone who like really, I don't think of myself as a YouTuber, I guess. Like, I don't really take that too seriously.
You don't have YouTuber in your bio?
Yeah, for sure. Like, I don't make videos and post them on YouTube very often. It's mostly just like, it's the most convenient way for me to do live streams, and I could use Twitch. I used to use Twitch, but then I realized like I keep my conference talks on my YouTube channel anyways. So
yeah,
I just kind of decided to double down on that, and I don't really pay attention to the comments too much. To me, like, YouTube is like a live streaming platform. It's not like a go and see like what engagement I'm getting on like old videos or whatever. It's just like, I want to live stream. I like working in public and hanging out with people in the chat, and I've always enjoyed watching other people work, so it feels like kind of fun. I feel like I'm more productive when I'm live streaming than when I'm not live streaming a lot of the time, because I can't get distracted. Like, I'm not going to go and read tweets when I'm live streaming. Yeah, you know what I mean? It kind of keeps you on task. And then Twitter, I'm on Twitter because that's where the tech community kind of lives, right? It kind of is our the equivalent of a forum for people in our industry. Sometimes I do like feel nostalgic about like the old days of, you know,
the old Twitter.
Like the old forums and stuff.
This
that format of like, there's a, you know, some different categories, and it's just, there's no threads, like there's no like threaded comments. It's just like linear. And
I got into so many good fights on those.
You know, I miss those days in a lot of ways, but we don't really have anything like that works for programming. Although I'm hoping that we can see more of that happening. Like GitHub is like, beta testing like this discussion feature. I don't know if you've seen on the Next.js repo, and we have it on the Tailwind repo now. So I'm really excited to see what happens with that. Hopefully we can have cool places to like talk about code and stuff that's not just on Twitter, where it just kind of like gets lost and there's all this like incentives to like create drama and stuff that are not really the same in a traditional forum format. But
engagement is king there.
Yeah.
So you've done a lot of things. You've put courses out. You've put books out. I'm curious. I know a lot of people are really interested in like how to make a living in open source or in like content creation. And I think a lot of times, at least from what I've seen, it's not necessarily like one particular like path. Like, you're not just like sitting in front of a computer and then people are paying you to like write open source.
Yeah.
But there's kind of like, you got to kind of find a couple different ways to make it work for you. And how long have you been independent now?
I think I left my job in May or June 2016.
Okay.
So coming up on 4 years.
4 years about. What are like the pillars of your, like, I guess, like independent income from like open source or like writing books or publishing courses, et cetera?
Yeah. So it kind of changes over time. Like the stuff that I do is, has like the income has kind of like a cliff, right? So I'll release a book and that'll kind of be the thing that pays for most of my income for a while, and that'll slowly trail off, and then eventually I'll release a second thing while the first one keeps trailing off. And that's sort of like the cycle that I've been in forever. So I did like the Refactoring to Collections, which doesn't really sell much anymore. Test Driven Laravel, which that one still actually sells like a decent amount. Then I did this Advanced View Component Design course, which I think has slowed down maybe a little bit more than the Laravel course. But that was kind of like the big earner for a little while there. Then we did the Refactoring UI book, and that still does really, really well. And that's been out for coming up on a year and a half, almost a year and a quarter. December 2018, I think we released that. And that was still like paying both me and Steve, my business partner, like very well up until when we released Tailwind UI, which was last month. So, but Tailwind UI, I guess, is our attempt at trying to do something that hopefully doesn't suffer the same like sort of cliff problem, like the way that the other stuff does, because it feels like you're always just have to come up with some new idea and figure out like the next launch. So even though it's still like a one-time purchase sort of product, we're hoping that with the having like tailwindcss.com as like a distribution channel for it, and continuing to grow how many people are using the framework, and, you know, adding new stuff and building out Tailwind UI more, that it'll it'll be a little bit more stable and not as like cliffy, but we'll have to see. And then maybe hopefully the next step, maybe it'll be something like recurring revenue, you know? So it's all just been kind of like stair stepping to hopefully get to something that is eventually a good long-term sustainable business. Did I miss part of the question there?
No. I think that's right. I guess I'm always kind of curious, like, I guess more like, and I think that you described it well. It's just the you have a product in mind, you build it, you publish it, and then there's kind of like this cliff and you kind of have to have the next one going. And then you've been kind of parlaying each of those into the next thing and learning a lesson along the way.
Yeah, for sure.
And kind of most recently with Tailwind UI, kind of selling that, but maybe even thinking like some type of service or like kind of recurring thing in the future.
Yeah, and we don't have anything like actually figured out, right? But it's always kind of like in your head as like, okay, well, hopefully just stair stepping towards things that are more and more stable over time, and even then just like having the diversity of revenue from like the many products. Like if it ever comes to it, I can go back and like re-record the test driven Laravel course, because it's you know, uses a much older version of Laravel than exists right now. So that can like breathe some new life into that product, or we could do a second edition of Refactoring UI. So there's definitely like people who make like a great long-term living doing content that is still like one-time salesy, but always have to be like thinking what's the best thing to be working on. And yeah, so it's nice at this point having like five products, I guess, because it plus revenue from other things. So like, you know, I have videos on Egghead, for example, that pay me like a couple $1,000 a month on top of the other stuff. So what's worked really well for me in general is just having stuff coming from a bunch of different places. Like on my podcast, I was doing sponsors for a long time. I just recently stopped doing that, but that was like a significant chunk of revenue every year too, right? So just finding ways to sort of like get 15% of my income here, like another 25% here, and kind of all adds up into something that makes it sustainable, you know?
Now, do you start with these like kind of grand visions of like, I want to do a book on this topic, or I want to do a course on this topic, or did these things kind of like show up organically? Like, do you kind of start talking about a thing, maybe posting some ideas on Twitter? Like, I know Refactoring UI kind of felt like, at least from the outside, this thing that was kind of organically happening, like, you know, it was kind of like some concepts, some demonstrations, and then it became Twitter stories, and then that was like a book announcement. And
yeah, it was a little bit of both. Refactoring as an interesting example, because we were pretty deliberate about trying to kind of build up to a book eventually. Like Steve originally wanted to do a book, because I had done a book and done courses, and he had seen like that it allowed me to kind of go independent. He was like, man, like I would love to be able to do the same sort of thing. I wonder if I could do like a design book. And this was before he really had an audience or anything. And we kind of got to talking about it. And I kind of gave him some advice on what he could do to sort of build his audience. Cause at the time he had like 600 Twitter followers or something, you know what I mean? And helped him come up with some ideas for what sort of content we could put together and stuff. So even like from like the very first time Steve started like tweeting like design tips, there was always a little bit of like, hopefully this can grow into something that I can eventually use to help me put out something that can allow me to go independent.
Yeah.
And we just kind of grew that for like 2 years before even like announcing the book. So it's a big investment, but the analogy I always like to think of in my head, it's just like compressing a spring. Like the longer you can like really like push down and like resist trying to like let that energy like release into like some sort of commercial thing, the more it's going to pay off. And that was definitely the case with that. Like that was like the longest that of any product that I've worked on that we had just like invested into just like, you know, really trying to like build the demand for it and build the audience around it. And then when we finally did it, it was like a way bigger success than any other stuff that I had done.
That is the best analogy that I've ever heard for that kind of like paying into it first and then like for waiting for the dividend. That spring idea, I freaking love that. How long was the kind of compression phase of Refactoring UI?
Yeah, like 2 years basically.
Wow.
Yeah. And it paid off for us for sure. The other products, like the first thing I ever wanted to do was like a testing book or a testing course. And if you look back in like my Twitter timeline to like 2000, 14, I bet you can find a tweet of me saying something about, you know, having an idea for that. But because I was working full time, like this grand vision that I had for this testing book just seemed like, I don't know how I'm ever going to find time to do this. And a friend of mine was actually doing educational content around like audio engineering, a friend that I met when I was like recording bands. So I went out for coffee with him and he said, he convinced me to try and come up with a much smaller product idea to just kind of like try it out and just like see how it goes. You know what I mean? Something that's like not as intimidating that you can actually make time for on nights and weekends. This was before I was a father, so that was a lot easier then. So at the time I had started building like a bit of a reputation for, and this was like totally just by chance, right? I had gotten really into learning about like functional programming concepts. Like I specifically remember the first time I learned like what a Raymap was, and I realized that like, holy crap, I've like written this from scratch a million times. Like var result equals empty array for each blah blah blah, put it into the result, return the result. You know what I mean? It's like, wait a minute, there's like a whole world of like abstractions around like these sorts of patterns, and that was like super exciting to me. So I like got really deep into that and like learning about all these different kind of list transformation patterns, and like learned Elixir because they had like really cool kind of standard library with all this stuff, and I wanted to play with some of those and see how I could use those to solve problems. And just kind of really overdid it to the point of just like trying to figure out like how to go as extreme as possible with some of these ideas. And the whole time I'd been sharing what I was doing on Twitter, just because that's how I operate. I like to participate in the community, throw ideas out there, things that I think are cool that hopefully other people think are cool, because like that's satisfying to me to see people kind of dig stuff that I'm doing. And so when I had this idea of trying to do something smaller, I thought, well, what are people kind of already paying attention to me for? And this like collections is what like we kind of call them in the Laravel world stuff. Was one of them. So I thought maybe I can put together like a little 40 to 50 page like mini book that just kind of is like a little recipe book for like all these cool different like problems and solutions that you can solve this way that I think people will dig. So I went ahead with that thinking, okay, I can do this in like 2 weeks. It's just going to be like a 40 page thing. It's basically going to be like 10 good blog posts or something. You know what I mean?
Achievable.
Yeah. And then about 6 weeks later, I had like 120 pages and, you know, I was like, wow, this is actually like a way bigger project than I realized. And, you know, I'd done a lot of reading and listening to other people who had launched eBooks, like Nathan Barry, who runs ConvertKit, is someone who I followed really closely at that time, just because I was looking for information on like, okay, well, if I'm going to do this, how can I do it in a way that has the best chances of like being worth my while? So reading a lot about that stuff. And, you know, so I put together a landing page and collected email addresses and sent out updates and free sample chapters and whatever. And by the time it was done, it was like a 150 page book, and I'd put together like 16 screencasts for it, which were just like taking some of the example problems from the book, but like recording a video for them. So most of the screencasts weren't like new content. It was just like the same content from the book, just presented in a different way for people who like video. Cause I think video is a really big thing in programming. People love watching. I mean, I know I do, right? So
in video, there's a lot of like nuance. You know, when you watch somebody, you can capture things that are like, you're watching a video on this, but then you see them do something else that you've never seen. You're like, oh, that's cool. I want that in my life.
Yeah, exactly. How did he just like uppercase that string in like a single command or whatever, right? Like cool stuff like that. So yeah, so I put together that package and released it, thinking like it would be really awesome if I could make like 20 grand from this over like the next 2 years or something. And it did like 70 grand or something in the first 3 days. Awesome. And I was like, holy crap, this is this is crazy to me. Like it totally like unlocked this part of my brain that like made me realize you can actually like make your own money. Like you can get people to pay you for things that aren't like your boss, you know, which was crazy to me. Like this had never occurred to me as like a really viable way to live. So when that did really well, I thought, you know what, like if I want to do this like testing book or testing course, whatever it's going to be, I feel like I need to do that right now because I have this big kind of like nest egg that I've got from this book, and that can kind of fund my time to work on this. And if I don't do it now, that money's probably just going to like slowly disappear into house renovation projects or whatever until eventually it's like I didn't really get to use it for any like life-changing opportunity. You know what I mean? It's going to go into the bank with all the other money and get spent on the same things all the other money gets spent on. So I quit my job like immediately. I released the book, got married a week later, went on my honeymoon, came back from my honeymoon. The day I got back from my honeymoon, I said, "Hey guys, I quit. I'm going to build this course instead." And then I worked on the course for like 6 months and opened that up in early access, kind of when I had hit a point that I had enough stuff that I thought people would want to check it out. And it took me like another year to finish it because it was like 160 videos, which was insane. And I'll never build something that big again. But that did way better than even the book did. I think that course has done like 700 grand or something in its lifetime.
Wow.
And then that was just kind of the start of it all. Then I wanted to do this Vue course for the same reasons that I kind of got into the collection stuff. I'd seen like Kent C. Dodds's Downshift library.
Yep.
And I thought, this is a really fascinating way to build UI libraries. Like, the problem with every UI library is that it comes with all these styles and CSS and you can never make it look right in your project. It always looks like this like kind of like bolted on thing.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Like jQuery UI like, back in the day.
Exactly. But with something like Downshift and render props and stuff, it's like, wow, there's like a way to let people build things that fit into their own apps without having to like maintain all this like complicated logic. And no one's talking about this in Vue. And I don't even know if you can do this in Vue. So I just started going down that rabbit hole, figuring out how do I translate these ideas into features that Vue has, and figured it out and put together a course on that because I had been sharing all that stuff on Twitter and people were really getting into it and people enjoyed conference talks I'd given on it and stuff. So that course I did a totally different way than the other course. I decided, okay, I'm just going to like, I have the idea. I want to launch it 6 weeks from now and have it be done because like the year and a half grind to do the other one, it just beat me up so bad.
160 videos.
Yeah. So I put together that. It was like 25 videos or something. I did it in the 6 weeks, released it. It did really well. And then after that is when I started kind of working with Steve on the refactoring UI stuff. And then we did that book like later that same year. And then last year, basically, we worked on some Tailwind CSS like 1.0 stuff and a bunch of stuff around the open source project. And then towards like Q3, started getting into the Tailwind UI work and then kind of put that out at the beginning of this year. And that's kind of been like the whole product journey. So
it's awesome. Now, one thing that I really noticed in the refactoring content is that there was I don't know if it was right from the beginning, but there was a point where it started to get branded. And I thought that was a really interesting approach. And I'd like to hear a little bit more about that, because I think you see a lot of like screenshots, you know, online, but it's really just kind of like this person tweeting about this concept. Yeah.
That was kind of Steve's idea. And I think it came from just people kind of sharing the images like without context. So it was more just like trying to figure out, okay, well, if people are going to share this stuff around, how can we make sure that people kind of can tell where it originally came from? So it's almost like a watermark in a sense,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Like a non-intrusive watermark. And I don't know if it's made like a big difference, but it has been nice to be able to see people like tweet those images directly with their own kind of spin on it, right? Which happens a lot. Someone will tweet something and be like, oh, this is like a really interesting idea because of XYZ. And they'll just share the image directly. But now like there's a way for people to kind of find us from it too.
Yeah.
So I'm sure it's helped. But yeah, not tons of thinking into it other than that, really.
Cool. Has it been kind of a virtuous cycle with refactoring UI and Tailwind? Because they seem to go kind of hand in hand, especially the way that you're like marketing and talking about them.
Yeah, they are definitely very complementary in a lot of ways. Like we try not to... We probably should do this, but we don't. With refactoring UI, we've been very deliberate about like just making it as standalone as possible, right? Like we don't talk about Tailwind in the book or anything like that. It's just like we're just teaching you design principles and giving you ideas. We want it to be as timeless as possible. It's kind of our goal, right? We want to make a book that like the ideas are going to be valid forever, and we don't want someone to look at it 3 years from now and think like, what's this like archaic? What's this CSS thing? Like, I thought we all used React, you know what I mean? So we try to keep it kind of separate in that way. But even then, like, there's lots of ideas in the book that are sort of just been like kind of baked right into Tailwind the framework. So like using a fixed color palette instead of like using SAS functions to lighten or darken things, like, you know, we've all done. Or using like constrained values for anything, like, well, using a spacing scale and how it should be designed so that it's like not linear and like the larger spaces should have bigger gaps between them than the smaller spaces. Like, there's a lot of things, like ideas like that, that just kind of get baked into Tailwind as a tool, which I think is a lot of the reasons why people have had good results with Tailwind, because it kind of helps you kind of follow some of these principles, like, in a sort of baked in way.
Because Tailwind is kind of like the implementation of those ideas. Like, you're having those ideas, you're having those discussions, kind of, you know, reading the literature and then writing about it in a kind of framework agnostic way.
Yeah.
But then you're building it into a tool like Tailwind that has those opinions and kind of, I guess, gives you that that like little extra boost of like, hey, you're starting from all of these opinions, almost kind of like Rails or Laravel in a way.
For sure, yeah, yeah. It has bakes in a lot of like the lower level opinions, anyways, about like, yeah, design system-y stuff, I guess. And then Tailwind UI is kind of like our attempt at taking some of the ideas that are a little like more bigger ideas that we share kind of under the Refactoring UI brand and building those into something that people can use, like, you know, advice about how wide a form field should be, you know what I mean? Like, that's kind of hard to bake into Tailwind because Tailwind's just like how wide a thing should be. It doesn't have any opinions about like what you're actually making with it. But yeah, there's definitely like a lot of synergy, I guess you could say, between them if we're talking enterprise Salesforce conference language. Yeah, so I think there's like lots of interesting opportunities for us to kind of play off those things a little bit better together too. Like, I think one of the reasons like Refactoring UI has continued to be successful is because of Tailwind, right? And kind of vice versa. We link to Refactoring UI from the Tailwind website in like a resources section. And that's been, if I look at like the Google Analytics stuff, we get like probably like 30% of the traffic to the Refactoring UI book comes from Tailwind, which is awesome, right? Like, it means like basically buying Refactoring UI helps like support Tailwind, and it helps make that more sustainable. And it's buried in this weird part of the website, but people still find it, you know. So it's cool to be able to kind of like link all that stuff together.
Now, you've hosted Full Stack Radio, which is an amazing podcast resource for developers, for a really long time. I think you're up into like a mid 130 episodes.
Yeah, that's right.
It's been like 4 years or something like that. Is that right?
Yeah. It feels slow to me compared to other podcasts, but
how is talking with developers, maybe like outside of your field or like designers kind of in different places, really influenced the way that you think as a developer, as a product person, as a designer?
I mean, it's been amazing. Like, to me, the whole reason I even started the podcast was literally because I had people in the world that I really admired their opinions and ideas on different topics, and I thought they had really interesting things to say, and I wanted to talk to those people. Like, I had questions for them about like a blog post that they had written or a conference talk that they had done, and I thought, you know, if I am just gonna like email this person and ask them questions, they're probably not gonna reply, or they're not gonna give me the best reply. Or if I say, hey, like, do you have time to do like a half hour Skype call with me so I can like harass you with all these questions, they're probably not going to say yes. But if I say, hey, do you want to be a guest on my podcast, well, then that changes things, right? Like, they probably will say yes, or at least I have a better chance. So creating the podcast was like a very selfish thing in terms of it was really just like a way to bait people into talking to me about the things that I wanted to talk to them about. So like Ryan Singer from Basecamp, he was like, I had very specific questions for him. And that's why I started the podcast, was to talk to Ryan Singer. Yes. So I did like 3 episodes or 4 episodes, and then I emailed Ryan Singer and I was like, will you come on my podcast? And he's like, yes. And I was like, amazing. So then I got to talk to Ryan for an hour about all the stuff I was really interested in. And then at the end of that conversation, I was like, man, I would love to be able to get like David Heinemeier Hansson on the podcast sometime. But I'm sure he's way too busy for that sort of thing. And Ryan was like, oh no, he does this sort of stuff all the time. Ask him. I almost promise he'll say yes. So then like 4 episodes later, I had DHH on the podcast. Awesome. I got to talk to him, and that just kind of like got the ball rolling. And yeah, so I've been doing it like bi-weekly essentially for like 4 years, coming up on 5 years probably. And it's been amazing because it's just this platform that I have that gives me the opportunity to talk to people that I want to talk to. Like, because of the fact that I try to stick to a schedule and stuff, like sometimes it happens that I have to like figure out an idea for an episode that maybe isn't something that I'm just like dying to figure out, the conversations all end up being really good anyways. But generally, like, the reason that I invite people on the show is because, like, I want to learn from them about something. So being able to just like record it and put it out into the world is just like a nice side effect of doing it in podcast form. But yeah, the whole reason I even do the podcast is to learn from people. So it's been amazing to be able to, you know, get my questions answered and apply those ideas in my work, for sure.
What have been some of the most transformative episodes or moments in the last handful of years of podcasting?
Oh man, that's a good one. I almost need to like look at the episode lists and see like some of the episodes that I can like remember specifically as being ones that were really interesting to me recently were, I had James Long on, who is a guy who created Prettier and is working on Actual, which is like this budgeting app, to talk about sort of like eventually like consistent data and like all this crazy stuff. And that was a really fun episode. You can tell, like, just listening to it, the ones where like I don't really have questions prepared, where it's more just like I am 100% engaged in everything that you're saying. And some things that you're saying are making me like, I don't understand that. You have to like explain that to me. And those are always the best ones, right? So that was like a really good one. I had a Guillermo Rausch from Zeit on a while back to talk to him about serverless architecture and stuff, which was super interesting to me for the same reasons, because it's just something that I was super excited about. When I had DHH on the first time, that was definitely like a crazy episode for me, because I'm like the biggest DHH fanboy ever. So being able to like ask him all these like really specific questions and dig into like how Basecamp is built, and very specific questions about like what do you do in your controllers, like what do you do here, blah blah blah, you know, like just talking code and stuff like that has been really awesome. And I mean, like, tons and tons and tons of good conversations, for sure. Those are some of the ones that stick out in my head recently.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, at least for me, that's been like something that's so fun about this is, like you said, having an audience so that you can just kind of say like, hey, I want to have a conversation with you. And I think I've learned that some of the most exciting time, like transformations for listeners, are when I have honest questions. Like I'm honestly like, I'm a fan of your work, right?
Yeah.
And like, I want to know how you did it so I can repeat it. And like, that's like such a fun thing to be able to do with anybody that you respect.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree that those are the absolute best ones. Like the podcasts I listen to, my favorite ones are ones that were just like the same two people every week, just like talking about literally like problems that they're facing and stresses that they're going through and like how to figure it out. You know what I mean? Like, those are always the most honest conversations, are always the most interesting and fun ones, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're kind of extended past an hour, but I do want to hit you up with one last question, which is just like, what are you excited about? Like, obviously we've seen a lot of the work that you're doing. We've been able to see kind of your career trajectory, and right now you're focused on Tailwind and refactoring UI. But what are you excited about for the future? Like the next like 3-5 years, what are you bullish on?
Yeah. So I've been thinking about this, cause you kind of softballed this question to me at the beginning of our call. And I don't know that I can say that like I'm specifically like bullish on anything, but I think like what I'm really excited to explore in general, and something I've been kind of passively exploring for years, but really want to dig into harder, and this will sound so funny to the people who listen to this podcast, is I've literally never built a single page app. You know what I mean? Like on like create React app that like talks to an API. I've always kind of worked in like that more like Railsy world.
Yep.
Where maybe you have like some JavaScript on the front end, or maybe you build the whole front end with JavaScript, but it's still really, it's talking directly to your back end and communicating with the database and whatever. And I've been passively like following along with it and learning about it more and more for years and years and years. And I'm really excited to like finally try it sometime, but I'm still like a skeptic, you know. I'm still and this is like, when we were setting up this call, I said that I want to have you on my podcast, and the reason that I want to do it is because I saw you tweet like the other day about the sort of like the Rails experience and how like there's nothing that really like matches that, and I really want to dig deep into that and kind of learn what you think about that. Cause I feel like it's always hard to know if like everyone building React apps also built Rails apps, or if like React is like the first web framework that they even encountered, and they just like
right.
have never written a query to talk to a Postgres database. You know what I mean? I don't even have exposure to that. Yeah. But it sounds like you've done both. So I thought it would be fun to sort of get into that because I'm so conflicted on like, I can see two versions of the future. I can see a version yeah. where it's like all backend stuff becomes like fully commoditized and everything yeah. is just like client bundles that we ship to people and you use a service for everything. Like you have some hosted GraphQL service and that's like your backend.
Well, you see stuff like OneGraph, which is like a collection of a lot of like open GraphQL APIs too. And it's like, okay, is like every, like, am I just going to hit OneGraph for like, you know, Stripe and data and like everything?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Like, but then I see like another version of it where it's like, I literally have never been able to get someone to name a single app that exists in the world that doesn't have a bespoke back end. Yeah. You know what I mean? So like everyone still has to write these custom yep. APIs. Every single company that I've ever seen, or at least any company that has like customers, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So what's going to happen? I don't know. It feels like sometimes I can't decide if I'm like trapped in the past when I'm like working with Active Record and like writing database queries and stuff like that, or if I have this skill that front-end only developers only wish they knew about, where they could really build something that they could actually ship into the world that was fully functional, you know? So that's what I've been thinking a lot about lately, is like where are things going to go? Are we going to realize that we've swung too far in like the trying to not write backend code direction, yeah. or is front-end code really going to take over the world? I don't know.
Well, I think you're the right person to explore it. You know, someone who has really done work on all levels of the stack, a true full stack developer. So I'm excited to have that chat with you, and I'm excited to see you explore those concepts in your live streams, in your life and going forward. Where can people find you? Where can people find your, live streams, you on Twitter, all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, sure. So Twitter is just Adam Wathan, all one word, ADAMWATHAN. YouTube is the same. If you want to check out Tailwind, just tailwindcss.com, and you can find Tailwind UI from there too. Refactoringui.com for Refactoring UI. And my personal website is adamwathan.me. The links to all that stuff too.
Cool. And Full Stack Radio, which is an awesome podcast. If you like this one, you'll definitely love that one.
Yeah. Awesome.
Awesome. Hey, thanks so much for being here. I really appreciate your time today and just sharing your journey.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me, man. It's been an absolute pleasure.
This has been episode 88 of React Podcast with Adam Wathan. Find the people and projects mentioned in this episode at reactpodcast.com/88. Thanks to our sponsor, Infinite Red. If you're hopelessly stuck in a React or React Native project, tap Infinite Red for help. They'll teach you your way out of whatever problem you face. Visit reactpodcast.infinite.red to start a new project today and get two tickets to Chain React Conf in 2021. If you like this show, there's a fast, free way to demonstrate your support. Leave us a review on iTunes. It's the best way for you to let me know what you think we're doing right and what we can improve. 2 to 3 minutes of your time helps us make the best show we possibly can. As always, links and show notes for all episodes are available at reactpodcast.com. This episode was edited by Mikhail Delport. It was produced by Mikhail Delport and Sarah Jackson at Spec, a network to help you level up in design and development. Check out spec.fm for other shows that are sure to fast-track your career. I'm your friend Chantastic. Thanks for listening. We'll be in your ears again next week.